Welcome to the latest United We Stand podcast. My name's Andy Mitten and I'm sat on a rainy Whitworth Street in Manchester. It's freezing outside, but it's warm inside, where I'm joined by veteran journalist David Meek. David is famous for his work on the Manchester Evening News, especially for covering Manchester United. He got that job in the wake of the Munich air disaster in 1958, a job he continued until 1995. He's no longer 21 anymore. I'd like to welcome you, David.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the reminder of how the years have gone by.
I know it's sometimes rude to ask your age, but...
82 now.
And still working.
Well, kind of. I've been retired from the Manchester Evening News for 17 years, so I'm relieved of the burden of waking up in the morning thinking, what the heck can I write today? But I suppose I operate as a freelance journalist now, the occasional MUTV work. And I do a bit for Manchester United. I help the manager with his words for the programme, which is... not a nothing job, in the sense that it's a 1,000-word piece for every home game, and I think it's, I can say fairly, that it's widely read, and that we've achieved a fair journalistic standard with it, as well as it being an important conduit for the manager to get his views over to fans and the public generally.
The manager's programme notes are picked up on all the time. They're interesting. They're good to read, and you can't say that of all match day programme notes. Sometimes it's dial a cliche a little bit. How does it work with you and the manager? Do you speak to him over the telephone a week before the game, 4 days before the game?
Only use the phone in an emergency, but the general drift is to for me to go and see him early in the week to produce the programme at the weekend, and this is an indication of the work ethic of the manager, because I have to be there on a Monday morning, which is our favourite day, at 7:30 in the morning. He likes to do all his sort of extraneous jobs at that hour before he gets busy with the running Manchester United. Before he has to start talking to the scouts and the physios and the fitness men and all the other people involved in a high-profile club these days. It suits me as well, because it means that we don't get interrupted. There's not a constant knock on the door, people wanting to see him from within the club. So I've spent 20 minutes with him, generally kick off and say, right, well, it's West Ham or whatever, Sunderland, I think it's the next one. How do you feel about that? And then off you'll go with a few words about Sunderland, or maybe the manager. He always has some views. I ask a few questions to bulk it up, because, as I say, it's a 1,000-word piece, so it's a little bit more than it's a pleasure to welcome the players, directors and fans of Sunderland to Old Trafford this afternoon. We try to get stuck into some topics that we think the fans will be interested in and talking about. There's a limit to the amount of inside knowledge that the manager will want to put out to fans, but I think he does his best to be as... open as he can, and I encourage him to be as indiscreet as I can within limits, of course. So that's how we do it. Then I go back and knock the article out, email it to him or his secretary, and she makes sure that he reads it. He's pretty conscientious with that. He'll often come back and say, no, it wasn't 3-1, it was 3-0. So he spots... I'd like to say deliberate mistakes. No, he spots my accidental mistakes, and he'll also maybe have thought of something during the week that he'll want to add, or something maybe that I've got a bit wrong that he wants straightened out or taken out. And then the revised version goes to the editor of the programme, Paul Davis, who puts it into shape.
Paul used to work on United We Stand.
I believe that's how he started in serious journalism.
Very serious. he had a choice out of the New York Times or United We Stand.
All right. Well, there's no brainer, was it?
And then there was a big money move to Manchester United. But he's a good lad, and he's conscientious, and he works hard.
Yes.
And he's a proper United fan.
I've enjoyed working with him.
And he's travelled all over Europe as a fan.
Oh, has he?
Yeah. Paul's proper home and away fan. I can remember, he might not appreciate me saying this, but going to Homebed away in 1993, and Paul's rail ticket didn't have the correct date on it. And Paul had to hide when the ticket collector came. Which, if you're catching a train to Liverpool, is one thing, but given it was an overnight train from Ostend to Budapest, was slightly problematic. So Paul slept underneath the chairs in our carriage. And I was in charge of the Matchday magazine at United. Yeah. But I think it's good that somebody like him works at the club, because he knows the club inside out. And he's very self-abasing, Paul. He's not somebody who wants attention, but he's really studious about his job, and he's very professional.
Well, I must say that it's a pleasure to work with him. I can see his professional background in the sense of working out deadlines for copy dates and stuff like that. And yet he's always very understanding if I say, well, you know, can we hang on a bit longer because the manager's in New York and I can't see him until he gets back. So we have a good working relationship and get on fine.
How does the manager's mood change depending on victory or defeat on a Monday morning? And what's he like with you? Because he's known you ever since he came to the club in 1986. That's a long working relationship.
Yes, I ghosted the previous manager's words in the programme. So he
Ron Atkinson.
Yeah, well, I did them all. Ron Atkinson, Dave Sexton, Frank O'Farrell, Wilf McGuinness, you know, back to square one. So he didn't see any reason at the beginning, anyway, to make a change. So he said, you've got the job. So how does his mood change? Very little. In fact, I think in many ways he tries harder to strike the right tone and to really say something positive if they're up against the ropes. You know, they've had a couple of bad results and results that they shouldn't have had, if you know what I mean, from the fans' point of view anyway. So I don't find him moody or sulking or blaming the referee. I mean, I have a go at referees and that kind of thing, but he doesn't look for excuses, and he gets into the nitty-gritty of it. And I always say that as a manager, I think he's at his best when there's a problem, when he's got his back to the in a corner, and that's when he comes out fighting. And I think that it's that attitude that gets United out of as many of the scrapes that they get themselves into, because that will be an attitude that won't change with the players or with the club or with the fans. He'll be consistent in that way and try even harder when things are not going right. But he's always sunny. I mean, it's early in the morning, and there was one morning when I felt, oh, I've got here before him. And so I had a cup of tea and I'm still waiting, and then in he comes, but he's been in the gym for half an hour, which says something for a 70-year-old to, with his workload, to find time to get in the gym. He comes in moaning and groaning a little bit about it, but that's that's fair enough.
You used to speak to him on a daily basis when you worked for the Manchester Evening News, in the days when the journalist from the Evening News would call the manager in the morning and get a story.
Yeah.
That's all changed now.
Yep.
You've mainly had a good relationship with him. Were there any moments where he didn't quite agree with any stories that you wrote? You've told me some in the past. Didn't you report that United had gone on an SAS course to Hereford?
Well, let's put it this way. The Manchester Evening News reported that they'd gone on a trip to Hereford.
And you got the rollicking for it.
I got the rollicking for it, yes. And that
what
was
did he say?
Well, it's what he didn't say to begin with, because he wouldn't take any calls from anybody connected with the Manchester Evening News. And it was coming up Christmas, and I thought, well, I can't let this sort of fester over the Christmas holiday.
I was on a work experience with you at the time.
Oh, that's right. Yes, you were.
It was in 1993. Yeah. I came into the Evening News to work with the Manchester Evening News United correspondent who wasn't speaking to United at the time.
That would have been very helpful. Well, it's not held you back any, has it? So I thought, I'm going to get this sorted out. So I went down to Old Trafford. It was about 3 or 4 days before Christmas. The team had trained at Old Trafford, which was a bit unusual. And Alex was playing seven-a-side or whatever it was on the pitch. And I was waiting at the top of the tunnel. And the tunnel was up a slight slope, the old one that was near the centre circle.
Still there?
Yeah.
Oldest part of the ground?
But not used.
No.
Anyone other, I think, I noticed the other day. The boys and girls would go out with the Sky... the UEFA sheet that and they waggle it, you know, for the cameras. They all wait at the top of that tunnel, and that's where they come out of. Anyway, I was waiting at the top of the tunnel, and he came off the pitch, and he started effing and jeffing about the Manchester Evening News at the bottom of the tunnel, and he didn't stop till he got to the top. Well, the exertions going up the slope, combined with his exertions on the field, left him pretty red in the face and slightly out of breath, so he had to pause when he got to the top. And I said, well, shall I tell you how the editor feels about this story, Alex? And I don't... And he was off again, you see, with a big, big rant. And so I knew I wasn't going to win this. So the next time he paused, I said, well, that's how you feel about it, and you're not prepared to listen. There's no point me talking to you any longer. So I was throwing my toys out of the pram then. I said, Merry Christmas, and turned on my heel to stalk away. And with that, his arm went out, went round my shoulders, big smile on his face. He said, nothing personal, you know. And that sort of defused the situation. But he was upset because at that time, Hereford, as the headquarters of the SAS, the IRA were very active. And he thought that if Manchester United were seen to be cozying up some terrorist might sort of put a bomb at Old Trafford or something like that. So he'd rather that they didn't report the story, which had come about because the head of security at Old Trafford was Ned Kelly, and he was an ex-SAS soldier.
He's back in Manchester now, Ned.
I believe so, yeah. And he had contacts at Hereford and arranged for the team to travel down to, you know, to see what went on, all, you know, storming a house and that kind of thing. Of course, the Evening News jazzed it up, and they did the story about United are going to study the SAS techniques and learn a few dirty tricks to help them win the championship, which they hadn't done at that point for umpteen years. So I can understand. I mean, his point, the manager's point, was that the paper is putting the lives of my players and family at risk, and he wasn't prepared to do that without a fight. But the editor's point of view was that, well, if he was so concerned about people seeing him cozying up to the SAS, well, he shouldn't have gone in the first place. So he had a classic, publish and be damned, or back down. Is the point of him having a blast at me was so that I would go back to the editor and say, look, next time the manager requests you not to print a story, will you give it a little bit more careful thought before you decide that you will go ahead and publish? Because, you know, he has a point, and he's absolutely livid. He's not going to talk to us anymore, and we don't really want to be at loggerheads as the local paper with one of the local managers. So that's what he wanted me to go back and say. And then I think because I'd built up a certain rapport and loyalty with him over however many years it was, writing his programme notes, etc., he thought, well, I won't whip the messenger too hard, just hard enough for him to take the message back. Then when I think he saw that I was getting a bit upset. Then my previous loyalty to him kicked in, and he took the personal sting out of it.
It's interesting you mentioned the IRA. I did Paddy Creran's autobiography, and Paddy told a really interesting story about how he went back to Donegal, where his family was originally from. When he crossed from Northern Ireland into the Republic of Ireland, there were British soldiers manning the checkpoint, including some young lads from Manchester. And they said, "Paddy, great to see you. We're United fans. We're from Wivenshaw."
Yeah.
And Paddy's reaction was to, "Nice to see you, lads. Hope everything's all right." But the people Paddy were with did not agree with the presence of British soldiers at that border checkpoint.
Oh, right.
And one of Paddy's uncles pulled him to one side and gave him the biggest rollicking he's ever had in his life.
Really?
Said, "If you're talking to him, you're a target yourself." And Paddy said he felt like completely torn between being friendly to United fans and getting drawn into a political situation. And you know, Paddy was born in Scotland, but he thinks he's Irish, and I still have this ongoing discussion with him.
Well, travelling with the team, I got a few vibes between him and Norman Whiteside.
Yeah. And you used to travel with the team, didn't you? You travelled on the team coach up until Frank O'Farrell's era.
Yes, indeed, and that was another run-in, but pre Alex. I liked Frank O'Farrell. He was an experienced manager. He was a gentleman.
He was an intelligent man. I interviewed him a couple of years ago. He was a bright fella.
Yeah. And he started off fine, but I think he had the team in the in the top three or four until one Christmas, and then they suddenly began to nosedive. Heading for the relegation zone. So there's a lot of talk, and the knives were out that he was going to be sacked. The media were talking about it, the fans were talking about it, and I imagine United We Stand were probably talking about the possibility of him getting the chop, were you?
We weren't around. We started.
You weren't? Oh, just as well. You'd have had a difficult decision to make. I had a difficult decision to make.
Well, in our first issues in 1989, there were talks about should Ferguson go? There wasn't a Ferguson out mantra, but it was widely discussed. And people were saying, this man is not the man for the club. And that was right from the off. And the very first time we sold United We Stand, October 89, is a game against Chelsea. And I remember a surge of optimism because, I think, had United won the game, they would have moved up from 11th to 6th.
Uh-huh.
And I remember thinking, wow, we couldn't be 6th if we win. Mm. And we drew.
Mm.
Imagine that now.
Just
completely alien concept, and everyone could, of course, pay at the gate. And the crowd was 13,000 higher than the previous home game because of the chance of moving up to 6. But
in Frank O'Farrell's day, of course, he'd only been there 18 months, so he hadn't had chance to build up any goodwill in the bank, so to speak. And it was quite rife, the talk, that he was heading for the sack.
What, in the pubs?
Yeah, in the pubs.
Because there was no internet then, was there?
No. But in the pubs.
Among fans.
Among the fans generally. And in the newspaper. The letters column, that kind of thing.
And that was an indicator of public opinion. The letters page in the local paper.
Yeah. So I wrote a piece which appeared in under a headline of Be Fair to Frank. And it was really arguing that they'd sacked Wilf McGuinness after 18 months. And here they are contemplating sacking Frank O'Farrell after 18 months. And I said that it's ridiculous because you've got to get some stability and continuity into the club. And Frank O'Farrell has serious problems of sorting out an ageing team. You've got to stand by him and stick by him.
All of which was entirely valid.
Oh, yes. I think so. And also, he'd signed Martin Buchan, but again, Martin needed time. His new setup needed time to develop. But the board were getting jittery, and so I wrote this piece about Be Fair to Frank and argued on the lines we just talked about. But they still sacked him, so that showed how much influence me and the Manchester Evening News had. But the cost for me was that they wrote a letter to the editor of the Manchester Evening News, saying I was no longer welcome to travel on the coach with them to away games, which was the custom in those days, that the local reporter was always taken around by the local team.
Rather than the nationals?
Oh, yes, there were no nationals.
So it was just you?
Yeah.
That was a privilege then.
So. Well, it was a privilege, yeah.
Because you could get to know the players very well.
Yeah.
You could.
Yeah, and it wasn't special for me or anything. It was what
it's a norm.
Happened in those days. I got sung off. I always remember that being called into the editor's office. The editor was the late Brian Redhead. Do you remember him on the Today programme and that sort of stuff? And he was a brilliant man to work for because he said, I've had this letter from Matt Busby and Les Olive and the United Board. You better read it. So I read it and it said, couched in sort of formal language about no longer welcome to travel, etc. He said, now then, what do you want me to do about this? So I said, well, I don't know. And I was stuck for an answer. So he answered it for me. He said, do you want me to write a letter of apology or tell them to F off? I thought, well, I said, well, can we do something a little bit in between? Kind of try to keep the channels of communication open. Saying you regret it, but you know, hope to continue working, etc. Which is, I think, what he did do. And I never got back on the bus, though. I'm still. Somebody did a little cartoon of me. The United team bus bowling down a road with me on a bicycle after, pedalling like mad to keep up.
So you had to drive to matches then, or did you get the train?
No. Well, the team travelled by train to a lot of games, the London games. They
so were you banned from the train? Had to get the train an hour later?
No. I made a point of principle that I always stayed in the same hotel that they were staying in, travelled as nearly as I could to the same timetable and on the same train. You've been talking about Pat Crerin. Now I've got fond memories of that period in the sense that when I'd be sitting on my own, which was obviously the case as the band pressman, not everybody wanted to be seen talking to me because I was a bit persona non grata. But Pat Crerin is his own man and he would always come up and just pass a few the time of day with me, which I appreciated at the time. It made me feel less of a pariah.
I think he's quite soft at heart. I think he's got this exterior of a fighting
hard man,
Glaswegian from Ireland, even though he's from Glasgow. but I think he's quite soft underneath it all.
Yeah,
even when he's fallen out with people.
Having said that, I wouldn't like to be to cross him and upset the hard Glaswegian part of him. Would you?
Well, no, I've always got on well with him. One or two differences of opinion.
Yes.
But he's I think it's great at his age that he's still going to all the matches, and I think he.
Well, I think he drives MUTV, even some viewers, a little bit around the bend with his outspoken comments and what have you. But it's good value as an MUTV pundit.
You've watched United for a long, long time at close hand. Who's the best player you've ever seen?
Well, I think. I can't get beyond George Best. I mean, if you were to ask who's the most influential player, Eric Cantona, who's been the loyalist and graced the club with the most dignity and made a tremendous contribution, Bobby Charlton. But in terms of magic as an individual, I think George Best. I mean, he played. People say he retired too early at the age of 27. He started at 17, for heaven's sake.
He had 10
years at the top in the first division with players like Harris of Chelsea trying to chop his legs off.
Chopper Harris.
Indeed. And not named that by accident either. So, and there was one period, though, when he was at his peak of 4 or 5 seasons, when I don't think he missed more than 7 or 8 games through injury. So he was a tough little so-and-so, as well as a quite magical player. I mean, he's the first player maybe Messi can do it now, but he's the only player I've really seen regularly running up to a player with the ball and then playing a 1-2 off the defender's legs. He would sort of use him as the wall, if you like, to kick the ball against his legs at an angle so that it would bounce past him into his path so that he could continue.
What was he like now, as a person?
I thought it was an accident the first time he did it, and he was lucky. But I saw him do it so many times that it was...
It wasn't fluke.
Deliberate. It wasn't a fluke.
What was he like as a person?
Well, I suppose I was never close to him because I was much older than he was, and he had an eye on the... even in his prime, he liked getting around town. He liked the clubs. I don't think in the early days that he was over-drinking or overdoing things, but he was out every night. You know, he was that sort of personality, and he had youth on his side to do it. But I'd got past that stage that I never really saw him socially at all. I mean, you wouldn't want to. I can remember my wife picking me up at Winslow after we'd been coming from a match in London by train. And George was going to his house in Bramble and got off the train at Winslow as well. And I said, do you want a lift? Can we drop you off? And he said, yes, please. So we went home to Stockport via Bramble, and
this is the famous space station house.
Yes, with the tiles on the outside, and then saw him sort of walk up to the house and ring the bell, and Miss Great Britain answered the door to him. Now that was not my league I operated in, so the answer is that I wasn't really close to George, but. He was always very pleasant and helpful if I needed a word from him. He wasn't the most flexible in terms of talking fluently to give you stories.
Who was the best speaker?
Well, of that era.
Or of any era. I mean, in terms of the players I've interviewed, Roy Keane was always really engaging of the United players because he was outspoken, but he was bright with it, but he made for good copy.
Yeah, well... Roy was coming to that point where a little bit towards the end of my writing career.
Yeah.
But the one before that, who I enjoyed interviewing and we had a good rapport, was Lou Macari.
Yeah.
Because Lou talked well and he was as honest as a player could be. And I always did a pre-season, like a preview for the season with him, and in which he talked about the team and the signings and all the things that you hoped he would speak about. Until one year, I said, right, come on, we're going to do our preview of the season, if you don't mind. And he said, no, I don't want to do it. I said, oh, why, have I upset you or something? He said, no. He said, it's just that we've got such a crap team that I can't say that. And yet I can't bring myself to make excuses that we're going to have a decent season. So he said, I'm best steering clear of it. But that was his honesty and one of the reasons why that made him such a good guy to get a story from.
What was the lowest period covering United? Lou was there when the team went down in the 70s.
Hmm.
Was the mood around the club at that time as low as you've ever seen, or was there another time?
No, it was the lowest. Although the low period didn't last for long because the dock breezed in, didn't they? And the dock with its hire and fire policy of
bringing like in Scotsmen.
It was like a revolving door, wasn't it? Players going in and out, and some hardly played before.
Well,
a lot of news again.
For you to report on, though, wasn't there?
Well,
a new player every week.
Yeah, I know. That's what made it such an exciting time. And I suppose I'm speaking now as a newspaper man and not necessarily as a supporter, because from the supporter's point of view, they couldn't see the value of bringing in some of the players that he did bring in. But from a newspaper point of view, it was great. Because it was non-stop action, the mood soon got lifted. And, of course, once they were in the second division, they started winning, and it was a very exciting team he had with Stuart Pearson at centre-forward, Steve Coppell and Gordon Hill, two of the most exciting wingers at that period in the game,
and,
or ever.
And perhaps couldn't be more different as individuals.
Oh, indeed.
Hill and Coppell.
No.
I've interviewed both of them, and they're both at the other different end of the spectrum.
You tell me, which of them did you find the easiest to interview?
Steve was very articulate, very bright, and probably articulated what it's like to run out in front of the Stretford end better than anybody I've ever spoke to, because he's done it. And he said it's like, you know, when you're in an operation in the operating theatre. And I said, well, no, because, you know, you've got more experience of that than me. He said it's like that when the anaesthetic's just about to kick in and you can feel in this sort of trippy la-la land, it's magical. He said that was the Stretford end. Gordon, I went to stay with him in 2010 with him and his wife Claire in Dallas, and he was great with me. He put me up overnight and he's absolutely crackers. He said, I'm not moving back in, let's get offered a job in the Premier League. And I said, but with the greatest respect, Gordon, your last job was as caretaker manager of Chester City 19 years ago, and you know, they lost 6 of the 8 matches. I don't think Aston Villa or Arsenal are going to be dragging you back from Texas at the moment. You know, yeah. He believed it.
Did he?
There was no way I was going to change him.
Right.
He's sort of friendly, likeable, you know, speaks first and then thinks about it,
what
he said later.
Yes. Well, I'm sure they're very accurate character assessments, but I maybe was a bit disillusioned in that, because I was there when Steve first arrived, I don't think he had the confidence, but he had the intelligence to realise that there would maybe be a little bit of resentment in the dressing room about this guy who'd taken a degree and was a graduate,
from Liverpool,
airing his views. So I got excited when I heard he was coming, because I thought, well, here's a guy who's a bit brighter than most. I'm going to get some cracking interviews. But he practiced the art of
saying nothing,
deflecting every question and saying nothing. And I was disappointed, because as the local reporter, you don't want guys who don't want to talk to you, and that's how it was coming across. Now, Gordon Hill...
likes to talk.
The other extreme.
He loves to talk.
You only needed to go into an interview with two questions, and he'd do the rest. I mean, it's typical of Gordon, isn't it, that they tell that story when he was down. I think it's Eamon Dumfries tells the story of how they set him up when he was at Millwall to say... and they said that we believe you're a bit of a tennis player, and the local paper have got wind of it, and they want to do a story and a picture of you as a tennis player in the team Mattel. And Gordon bought this hook, line and sinker, went out and bought some, well, he probably had white shorts, but he got himself a tennis racket, etc., and he's pacing up and down in the foyer of the Mattel waiting for this fictitious reporter and photographer to come to take a picture of him and interview him as a tennis player. Until his teammates bombed out from behind the pillars and went yaboo. But I think he took that in his stride. He didn't destroy it. It would have taken a lot to have destroyed Gordon's confidence. But he was willing to say stuff and be critical even of the manager. I mean, you have to protect...
imagine that now.
Yes. He wouldn't have lasted 2 minutes with Alex Ferguson, would he? But you had to protect him. But that's okay. I saw that as partly one of my responsibilities as a local reporter.
Yeah, where they tell you too much and you realise they say this.
They're digging their own.
So that's where the trust thing comes in between the journalist and the player. I've had a few players like that. John Gidman in most paragraphs, actually, of the things that he says.
Yes.
He once gave me an interview. I said, I better let you see this, John, before it's printed. Mm. I expected him to put a red line through everything.
Mm.
And he rang me back and said, yeah, great, great, but can you not have a bit more of a go at the ex-missus?
And Yes, he was always good value for the local reporter, yes.
Yes. So Lou Macari once rang Gordon Hill up when they were staying away up in the northeast and pretended to be from Tyne Tees Television, mm-hmm. and said, you know, we want to speak to you. You're the big star of this Man United team. Come to the studio tomorrow night at 5:30. Gordon got a cab there and turned up at Tyne Tees Television for an interview, and the receptionist didn't have a clue.
No, really?
Lou reckons that he came back to the hotel and told everyone that it had gone well.
Really? Mind you, Lou Macari was at the heart of most of the prank stuff
done
that
some
carried
brilliant
on.
Did he do any on you?
Well, indirectly, we had a press football team.
Juventus.
I'd forgotten that bit, but maybe it's a different story. But anyway, we'd played at the Cliff, the club kindly lent us the ground to play, and you know the tradition in those days, particularly at the Cliff, they gave you a brew of tea at half time, in a whacking great big industrial kettle, and Lou had cut the toes off the socks of all the journalists who were playing in the game and put them in the teapot, along with a few tea bags. I mean,
Lou reckons that the journalists were drinking the tea, going, this is a really nice cup of tea, and it had been made with their socks.
Yes,
he also put a nail in Ray Wilkins' new shoes. He nailed them to the floor because he felt that they were a bit flash and a bit London. And he said that he put his foot into this new shoe, this loafer, and couldn't move. He just sort of stuck to the floor.
Lou. And he also got into the habit, when we were on pre-season tours, Lou was the ringleader in that he used to get into the rooms of some of the journalists and take all their clothes so that all they would have on was what they were actually wearing at the time when their clothes were pinched. And Bob Russell of the Daily Mirror was a favourite victim. And so Bob only had what he stood up in for what seemed like days. We were based in...
Because Lou'd stolen his clothes.
Yeah, and hidden them. And then he said that... the press had to pay penance to get them back. And so, of course, we didn't really want much to do. It was Bob's problem, but Bob pleaded and said, you've got to do what they are. So he had the press doing press-ups in the hotel foyer. So many press-ups as part of the punishment, if you like, or the penance that we had to do to get Bobby's clothes back. That went on for days.
He locked Paddy Roach in his bedroom in Belgrade for a couple of days with Gerry Dale.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, yeah. It was a real problem, like 38 hours. So disconnected the phone. They were hungry.
I bet they were.
That's all gone now, hasn't it? That relationship between... Mm. It hasn't completely gone, because I see some journalists saying they don't speak to players anymore, they speak to people close to the players, but I can speak to some players, you know. It's maybe not like when you played, but...
Wrote,
sorry. I shall make a note to edit that. Maybe it's not like when you worked at the evening news and, you know, you've travelled with them all the time, but it has changed, hasn't it, the relationship between the media and the players?
Yes.
For the worse.
Yes, I mean, there's a classic example this week with Manchester City, isn't it? After their European defeat in the mixed zone, which UEFA order, all the players have to go through and the journalists have the opportunity of asking them a question. Not one of them would stop.
Yeah. I hate the mixed zone.
Even Kompany, who, as the captain, who is regarded as one of the, you know, the ones who will stand up to his responsibilities, said, and walked by. And that was an instruction from the media department in Manchester City, because they were upset at the way a previous story had been handled. So it's always teetering on the edge of these days, I think, of the relationship. My relationship overall, I think, I can say sort of quite proudly that when I retired from the Manchester Evening News, the Association of Former Manchester United Players made me an honorary member, along with all the other ex-players. Now, the only honorary members that they made was, I think, the club doctor, Jimmy Murphy, and people like that who they got on with and liked. I was going to say Les Olive, but Les Olive played for United, so he was a bona fide member. But I was very touched when they, obviously, we had run-ins with players, which you do over 37 years, but that all went by the by. They recognised, and that was really, the people who ran the association, still do, were mostly from the 60s, and it was their influence that got me an honorary member, and I see them socially, and it's lived on, the relationship, for what looks like being the rest of my life. So that doesn't come out of nothing. So as you suggest, the relationship in the old days, we had the opportunity to get a bit closer.
We're coming to the end now. What final couple of questions? Which story was you most proud of breaking? And which story did you get completely wrong?
I was at the World Cup. I can't even remember where we were now, but it was when Bobby Robson was the manager.
Mexico 86, Spain 82, Italia 90.
And Brian Robson came home early with a damaged shoulder.
Monterrey. Right.
Well, for some reason, I stumbled on the fact that Brian's shoulder was not going to get better and that he was being sent home early from the World Cup to get it either operated on or assessed, and etc. And everybody was speculating about when he'd be playing again. So I broke the story that he was on his way home. That was on the Saturday night in the pink, and he was flying home, I think, on the Sunday. I think he'd actually flown home that Saturday.
How did you know? You spoke to him?
No, he didn't tell me himself. It was a bit of a friend kind of thing.
Yeah. An unnamed source.
Yes, and it had the ring of reality about it. So I held my breath, mind you.
Yeah.
After I'd sent it, but it worked out to be accurate. So I was proud of that because it was in front of my peers. I mean, when as a local paper, you expect to get some stories first because you're the local paper and it's your local club, and so they tell you first. So you can't claim all those first scoops, but that was in competition with, you know, the dailies, the Sundays, and everybody. So I felt proud of that. And which did I get completely wrong? Well, I won't lie and say, well, there weren't any. I'm sure there were quite a sum, but maybe I've blanked them out because one won't spring to mind anyway.
Thank you for your time.
Pleasure.
You enjoying watching United? Do you get to many games still?
Yeah, I get to most of the home games.
You're still living.
You asked me that question on a bad day because I went to the match against Cluj last night and it was so cold I left at half time.
And you still live locally?
Yes, in Sale.
Yeah.
10-minute drive from the training ground, which, I mean, suits me for doing the manager's programme notes.
Perfect. Do you still take him your copy of United We Stand every month?
Of course I do. It's edited by my favourite journalist.
And finally, how will United do this season?
I think they'll be okay. You see, United fans, and I say this deliberately to the editor of a fans' organisation, there's nobody more critical of their team than Manchester United supporters. In fact, I once wrote in the paper that if you were to give a cup for the most cantankerous, complaining set of supporters in the country, Manchester United would win it hands down every year. I do think they expect the impossible. They don't make allowance for it's a game. They've no divine right to win, and they've no divine right really to be able to produce even a scintillating performance every week, because the other side are trying to do that and are there to stop them. So it's not always possible. And yet I like to think that I've retained my balance as seeing football as a game that can swing either way or both ways, but another United supporters can't. So they're constantly picking on the Manchester United problems, and I keep coming across United. Oh no, we won't do anything this season. We're leaking too many goals. We've not got a good enough defence. We need a driving midfielder. We haven't got this. We haven't got that. Problems. Yes, they are problems. But ignoring totally the fact that every other team have got problems. The problems at Chelsea and Arsenal are becoming more apparent because they've slipped down the league. But I mean, Manchester City are the only other team who are going pretty well. But don't tell me that they've not got problems. I mean, they've come a cropper in Europe. I still think there's something flaky about a team of so many big money mercenaries. I thought Sir Alex was very shrewd when he said the other day that he wasn't exactly glorying in the fact that they're out of Europe. But he did make the point that with a squad of the depth and quality of City, unless you have these other competitions, you can't keep the players happy because there are not enough games to play them. And Mancini's already talking about needing more players in the next January transfer window. So I think there's something flaky about City. And I think they'll have problems. They've gone off the boil. They're not as good as they were. So I fancy United strongly because I think, okay, there are problems, but there always are at every team, every level. I'm sure Barcelona and Real Madrid talk to their fans and they can see problems.
Real Madrid, if they don't win either the European Cup or the title, it's perceived to be a disaster.
Mm.
Ridiculous level of expectation.
Yeah.
Ridiculous. Mm. They can play brilliant football, but if they don't win the league...
Yeah. Counts for nothing.
Thanks for your time.
Pleasure, Andy. Anytime.
So that's it for the final United We Stand podcast of 2012. Hope you've enjoyed the podcast that we've brought you this season, and we'll be back in the new year with more interesting guests. All the best for 2013, and if you're feeling particularly inspired, please feel free to contribute to United We Stand. Drop us an email to uwsmag@yahoo.co.uk. We're always looking for top quality contributions. Until next week, goodbye.